So the soul of a worm, what does that mean? It washes, brings it, and cleans it again. That has been removed and eliminated. Only grains of gold remain. This is the simile, which the Buddha is always a master of similes. There's so many similes in the suttas. This is one of the main ways that he teaches, by using similes in this way. And having here we have the idea of how to refine gold. Yeah, this already is an interesting idea. Why don't you just put up use gold to talk? What's the point of using gold here? The point, obviously, is that gold in the world sense is very valuable. You know, you travel almost everywhere you go in the world, gold is considered valuable. Yeah? So he's choosing, deliberately choosing one of the most precious things that has known to humanity. Yeah? It's weird how everywhere you go, gold is almost considered something special because it's shiny, because it's, you know, all of these kind of qualities to it. And of course, the point is that the mind is also very, very valuable when it is refined, when it is purified in the right way. Yeah? It's so, in fact, it is far more valuable, of course, than gold at the end of the day. You don't get that much happiness out of gold. Yeah, okay, you know, you get a gold bracelet or whatever, it's not such a big deal. But when you purify the mind, it is valuable to far, far, far greater extent. The Buddha kind of closes in as close as we possibly can, using gold and the idea to show the value of a pure mind. Because the pure mind, and the Buddha says this elsewhere, is something which enables you to experience. You've got enormous amount of happiness. Happiness almost without limit. This is the gold. So we are on a gold, a refining journey. So we're doing it. We're trying to seek the gold. Gold, the inner gold, at the end, the inner beauty inside. This is what we're looking after. There are also many characteristics in common between gold and the mind. One thing is that the mind which is purified is actually shine. Yeah, it's a most radiant mind. Yeah, it's a radiance, kindness, it is very expansive, there's no limit to it. And of course that is similar to gold, which is refined as well. It is radiant and shining. Yeah. The mind also feels, you feel the inner sense of shininess when the mind is shined up and brightened up in this way. Yeah. This is already significant. The Buddha, some of the similes, when you read them, remember, they are very meaningful very often. Yeah? Every word almost often has a meaning. Yeah? So you have to try to relate to these words in the right way. Yeah? And as you do that, the power of these similes actually come out as a consequence. Gold, yeah? And the other thing which it comes out in the simile, or the first thing the Buddha talks about, the gold refiner and his apprentice, yeah? The gold remover was his apprentice. So I guess the Buddha is the original soul remover, and we are all the apprentices. Yeah? So remember that, you're an apprentice of the Buddha. That's pretty cool. The Buddha there is the master, and he shows us how these things are done. Yeah, that's what we do when we read the sutta. And we are like the apprentice, learning from the Buddha directly. You are worthy to be the apprentice of the Buddha. Yeah. Come together. Yeah, sometimes I think, oh, I'm not good enough, I can't do this. Buddha, whoa, Buddha is so amazing. He's like, no, you know, how can you possibly do this? But no, the point is, we're each one of us, we are worthy of being the apprentice of the Buddha. Yeah, and this is kind of the important point here. And so you read this, and then when you feel that the Buddha is taking you on board as your apprentice, you also take the Dhamma more seriously. Because you think, wow, okay, I've got to kind of live up to the expectations now, yeah? That means you kind of put a bit of extra effort into your fine research and all these kind of things, because you want to make yourself worthy of that honor of being the Buddha's apprentice. So what does their practice do? What does the Buddha do? So the Buddha, if you want to purify your mind first, and then we purify our mind after, depending on that. But you will notice here that there is a particular sequence to the purification. Yeah? It's not a random thing, you don't just do random stuff, a bit of this, a bit of that. Hopefully it comes out. There's a very deliberate sequence. The sequence is you start with the coarse things, you take out the gravel and the coarse things. Then you move on to the intermediate particles, and then you do the fine things afterwards. It's crazy, you start all the way around, it's going to work, yeah, you start with the fine things. Doesn't make any sense. So it's a very clear sequence. And that is also the case for the purification of the mind. Yeah, there's a sequence in which you have to do this. Und look at that sequence in the Sutta. And if we miss out on that sequence, if we get the sequence wrong, then it's not going to be very effective how we do this. And the sequence is pretty obvious when you think about it. But it's important to remind ourselves of that. So people often say, oh, I really want to get those karmas. Yeah, I want to get those. But have you done the sequence yet? Have you kind of started with the dogma? Or do you just want the dharmas and that kind of putting in the preliminary workshop? This is the problem. If you sequence, if you haven't got the sequence right, it makes it impossible to get those dharmas and those insights. It depends on doing things in the right order. So course defilements first, open the gold, yeah? Gold has defilements, just like your mind has defilements. Course defilements first, then the living defilements, then the refined defilements, and then you might discover the beauty of the gold at the end of all that. So do things in the right way. This is where brainwashing comes in. You see, it takes the trust and you washes the gold, yeah? So the same way we wash out the mind and the fingers and wings, yes. This is why this is good. So, what else? Is there anything more in there that is worth noting? And then you have only the grain of gold that remain. And then the Buddha says further, the goldsmith, yes, the soul remover has done his job, and the goldsmith comes in. The goldsmith is probably the reader, the Buddha. The goldsmith or his apprentice now pours the gold into a melting pot. Fans it, smelts it, and smelts it. And even when this has been done, the gold is not yet settled, and the dross has not yet been entirely removed. The gold is not yet malleable, weedily luminous, but still brittle and not properly fit for work. So you take out all the defilements, and there's some tiny, minor defilements left, which are there, and that's why the mind is not kind of fully luminous yet. The dross are not being entirely. So this is the last thing we have to remove, this last kind of defilements. But as the goldsmith or his apprentice continues to fan, melt and smelt the gold, the time comes when the gold is settled. And the dross has been entirely removed, so the gold becomes a malleable, wieldy, luminous client, and properly fit for work. Then, whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, whether a bracelet, an earrings, a necklace, or a golden garland, he can achieve his purpose. So you keep on melting that gold, smelting it, fanning it, doing what it requires. You keep on practicing it. Don't really know exactly at what point the mind is going to be pure, the gold is going to be pure. It's hard to know exactly when this happens. Yeah? But as you keep on doing it, eventually the point comes when the mind is ready and purity has been achieved. You just have to keep on applying yourself. And you know, one day it's going to happen. There's a very powerful message in that. You know, when it says, when the Buddha says this, that comes the time, yeah? And what that means is that we should never focus too much on the result. Yeah, just like the goldsmith, he doesn't focus too much on the result, hopefully, otherwise he's going to get very frustrated. But he just keeps on fanning it. He keeps on melting and smelting. And as it does that, the time will eventually arrive when things kind of work out. The gold finally is ready, and finally it can be used. So forget about the gold. Forget about where we're heading. Put the effort into the causes for the practice. Yeah? When you sit down in a meditation, never expect anything in particular. Just sit down and say, okay, I'm just going to sit back, relax, and enjoy myself and see what happens. And when you do that, meditation becomes so much more delightful, so much more beautiful. Because all of this focus on results, always this leads to craving, leads to desires, leads to trying too hard, leads to effort. Instead of actually looking at, well, what is that right now? What is the cause right now for getting there? The cause right now is relaxing, being at ease, feeling kind of positive at the present moment, all these things. How did the real cause of the meditation actually happen? And it's actually the same way. So it's a powerful little teaching just in that. A simple word, it comes a time, rather than when I want it to happen, then it will happen. It doesn't work like that. And then the gold has all this quality for this happens. It is malleable, yeah, he's trying to wield it, in other words, that it can be used, that the goldsmith can use it. And now it is luminous. Yeah, only now is the mind really the gold luminous. And this is exactly what the sutras also talk about, the mind being luminous, the tapasana chitta. One of those words that we find that describing the mind, is how the mind in particular in the sutras, how the tapasana chitta. Sometimes people get the wrong idea. They think, oh, that's that is like nirvana, it's like some eternal mind that is over there. But in the sutras, it doesn't mean that. A vastrachitta just means a particular type of mind that has been conditioned in a particular way, but has been conditioned through the practice of the path, and then it becomes luminous. But the luminous mind itself is also conditioned, it's not an unconditioned mind, it is conditioned through your practice. By the what we have been doing, if you stop your practice, you're going to lose that luminosity of the mind again. Yeah, so it has also come into existence through causes and effects. It is not something that exists like that, but it's always luminous, always whatever it is. So this is a kind of important point, because sometimes we read more into the sutra. It's kind of, it can be a little bit difficult to get this right. It can't be too much in the sutra, not too little, but to find that kind of middle ground again. Perhaps not midway, but a bit rounder. And then the gold is ready. Yeah? Gold is properly fit for work. You can use it for whatever you want. So how does this relate to our practice of the past? And this is what the Buddha talks about next. So too, because when a bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mindset, there are in him gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. Earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. Yes, there are gross defilements, and when this has been done, there remain limited defilements, and then you can get the subtle defilements at the bottom there. Three kind of grades of defilements as the Buddha distinguishes between here. So, first of all, bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mind, the adhicitta. You are devoted to samadhi, that's what adhicitta means. You're devoted to samadhi, you want to kind of eventually reach the jhana state. So this is what this is kind of heading to. So someone who is in a kind of indirect way trying to move towards the very higher aspects of the path, the adhicitta. And we have too much craving, we have too much desire, but this is kind of where you are heading, the kind of purpose of this. So if you are, if that's what you're interested in, I think everybody's interested in that, yeah, it sounds nice, a higher mind, it sounds like a good thing, yeah. So if you want the higher mind, the lower mind doesn't sound very good, yeah. I think the higher mind is much better. So if you want the higher mind, this is what you're going to do, yeah. So this is a teaching on that. So basically it's a teaching on how to get to the very end of the path. So first of all, what you have to do is you have to remove those gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. And this refers to external misconduct, mostly. Obviously, bodily and verbal is always external, but this refers to things like, the way you remove this, not keeping the five precepts, yeah? This is how, what it means. What about mental misconduct? What does that mean in this particular context? And mental misconduct in this context means very coarse aspects of mind and tends to make you break the five precepts. Yeah? So any kind of very coarse aspects of the mind which leads you in that direction, that is what is kind of meant here by the mental misconduct. Because there's more mental discomfort coming in a second. That's more kind of the refined states of the mind that you were talking about in the very coarse ones. And if you want to read about those right bodily action, right verbal action, and a good place to look is in the, I was mentioning the sutra the other day, the Salayaka Sutra. We have 10 courses of wholesome action, 10 courses of unwholesome action. That's a kusala kamapata, that's a kusala kamapata. And it summarized very beautifully the idea of right bodily action, right verbal action, also right mental action. And it kind of brings out all the various aspects of it. So the my precepts often is not enough. Yeah? Also, you have to do more than that. You have to, in the five precepts, all you have is not to lie. But really, we have to go beyond that to have a speech. So we have to speak in a way we avoid the other factors of it, like divisive speech, speech which is harsh, and even idle chatter. When we have a purified mind, all of these respects, that is when this class becomes very powerful. And one way of doing that is to deliberately do the opposite. One of the nice things about the Buddha's teachings, which I always kind of encourage people to think about, is that when the Buddha crosses that sila, Ajaya sila often translated into morality in Buddhism, but actually the word sila means much more than that. Sila has to do with our personality, has to do with our habits, who we are as people. There's a very broad thing there. And of course, our personality, our habit, is not just about wanting to do bad things, it's about deliberately doing good things. Yes, you don't just not speak divisively, you speak to unify people, you bring people together there. You don't just don't speak harshly, you speak gently. You don't just avoid idle chatter, but you speak meaningfully. You speak things that have to do with kind of people's, to help people, to support them. I think that are, have a real meaning about Dhamma, if you want, about how to train the mind, about it. And you don't always have to talk about this because people think I'm nuts if you talk about this all the time. So, and this is also the thing about the Buddha. You see the Buddha when he goes out and he meets people the first time. He often has his starts about being friendly. He says something kind to people. They exchange courteous talk. What he says in the suttas, you are friendly with people as well. How are you? How are you, David? Nice to see you again. Wonderful. By the way, I read the sutta. Quickly get to the point. I'm exaggerating. Exaggerating is for the effect. But this is kind of the idea. I mean, what it does, it makes your mind more peaceful, more collected when you do things that is not making you work. So this is this is all about sila here. And sila very broad, about our character. A person who has really good sila is a person who has a good character. That's really what it means, Someone who is kind, friendly, and all these qualities in their heart. You practice this, and remember, you have to get these things in the right order. So it's always good to look at your life and look at whether you actually are successful in these aspects of sila, whether you have, practiced these things fully. Because only when you have practiced these things fully can you really move on to the next stage. What is interesting here as well is that you have these words earnest and capable. Satchetaka, it means almost like reflective, like you have your mind with you, so you are a kind of a reflective kind of person. In other words, you are heedful, you are careful about how you live your life. Earnest, it's a simple kind of word, you are kind of skilled and fit for what you are doing. It means that these things are not easy, they don't happen automatically. You don't purify yourself. I've been saying all the time, you just listen to the word of the Buddha, and these things happen. And then, of course, it is true, but the point about the word of the Buddha is that he makes you commit to these things. He makes you do the practice. You listen to him, you get inspired, and you do it as a consequence. But it doesn't mean that it's easy. And the reason why it isn't easy is because our habits are so strong. And when you change our habits, we need to learn how to move in a different direction. And that is always what is so hard about it. So you have to have that earnestness. You have to have that perseverance. You have to have that willingness to challenge some of your deeply ingrained habits. And only then is it going to work. So remember that. This is not it's not a difficult one. Anyone can do it. But it takes that commitment to the practice, and only then is it really going to work out. You've got to be earnest and skillful at these things. And when you are, what happens? What do you do? You abandon, you dispel, you terminate, you obliterate this bad and this conduct. So you are like, you take a sledgehammer and you kind of pulverize it. Is that what you do? It sounds a bit like it, isn't it? Obliterate it, terminate it, dispel it. Sounds like you use a lot of force. Sounds like you kind of become Arnold Schwarzenegger or something. You kind of just pulverize everything in your mouth. But be careful here, and sometimes the suttas, they use words that may not be very obvious what they actually mean. If you read the Pali here, the translation is actually not entirely wrong. The translation is actually getting to maybe roughly what the Pali is actually. Maybe the Pali is quite as forceful as this. It does sound like an enormous amount of willpower. So, but be careful, because one of the things, this is something I will not be reading out to you on this retreat, but there's a very nice sutta which I read here last year called the Veda Vitaka Sutta, Two Kinds of Thought. And in that sutta too, it tells you that you do this to your bad thoughts, and you dispel them, obliterate them, you make them non-existent, you annihilate them, It's kind of the language that is used. But in that sutta, it's very clear that the way that you do that is not actually through willpower. Don't bring out the sledgehammer. You don't start pounding away using all the force you have. That is not actually the right way. You don't need to use willpower. People often think about sense restraints. If you're going to reduce your anger or reduce perhaps some of your desires, use sense restraint, use force, just hold back the mind, your teeth. No, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to be angry. You suppress the anger. Then somehow, that is what sense restraint is all about. But it isn't really about that. You go to the, it can be about like an extreme or in special circumstances, but generally speaking, that is not the meaning of sense restraint. Even these words here, you may think, this looks exactly like willpower. Actually, it is not. According to the Veda Vitaka Sutta, the Buddha says the way he overcame these defilements of the mind was by reflecting. Purely by reflecting. If you reflect in the right way, then you will overcome these things. That is the power of right reflection. The Buddha says there, all he had to do was to reflect. This leads to my own suffering. This leads to the suffering of others. This leads to the suffering of both. This leads to the cessation of panya, panya nirodhika. This leads away from nirvana. This leads to problems, agata problems. All you need to do is to remember that this is problematic. This is going to lead to more suffering for yourself. Then these thoughts, then these unscriptural ways of doing things will just go. But of course, to understand that, to actually understand that these things do lead to suffering, for yourself and others, you need to reflect on it. Why is it that anger leads to suffering? Well, I think it's, that one is fairly obvious. These are enormous kind of problems. But what about desires? Well, you have to reflect a little bit about your desires and see how they too very often lead to suffering. And we'll talk about this maybe a little bit more later on. And it is through this kind of reflection that generally speaking, we move from wrong conduct to right conduct. And this is going to be part of what I'm going to do here, to show you how to reflect in the right way. The Buddha shows us, remember the other day, you get saved in the Buddha model, and then you get Yoni Somanasikara. This is what he's talking about. Yoni Somanasikara, the careful attention, the heedful attention, the wise attention. You learn that, and then when you do that in the right way, these things are not natural. Why does the word Buddha use such powerful words like obliterated, dispelled, annihilated, done away with, etc.? Why is this wrong word? And the reason is that it's actually quite obvious once you get to, once you understand what's going on here. The reason is that if you try to obliterate by using willpower, if you say, I'm not going to allow this anger to arise, and you force your mind to be in a certain way, what happens is that willpower takes a lot of energy. You will only be able to sustain it so long. When you run out of energy, I'm exhausted. Anger and all the defilements, they often come back again. Sometimes you forget about it in the meantime, but sometimes you don't. And then it comes back again. You haven't really dealt with the root problem. You haven't dealt with the cause of the anger. So as soon as you think about this person that upsets you, anger comes back. And you don't know. You didn't want to try so hard. You come back again. And then in the meantime, you've exhausted yourself, you don't have any more energy to control that thought, and then you have a problem at your hands because of that. So you can't really obliterate anything through suppression, through using willpower, because the underlying problem is still there, it comes back again so quickly, and you also exhaust yourself. That's why the Buddha says reflection is the way to go. When you reflect, when you learn to reflect in the right way, And what I mean by reflection here is like, I see one of you irritates me really badly. Nobody here is irritating at all. This is just an example, yeah? And then I get this irritation coming up, and I think, well, wait a minute, why am I getting irritated by these wonderful people? Yeah? There's so many positive things going on here, so many wonderful things. People who are trying to live well, trying to do the right thing. So I shift my attention away from that negative thing which irritates me, and instead I see the positive things in people. And if you do this in the right way, at the right time, it is very, very powerful. And this is what I mean by using reflection. Yeah? This is what I mean by using wisdom to actually overcome defilements. It's incredibly powerful. And anybody can do this. And of course, when you do that, you are no longer suppressing the thought. Suppression can also lead to all kinds of psychological problems in the long run. You're no longer suppressing it. What you're doing is you're shifting your attention. And as you shift your attention in this way, your mind state simply changes. You have a new mind state. Nothing is suppressed. Nothing is kind of there's no kind of sense of, and then when it disappears because you're changing your entire mind, it's gone. It really is obliterated, yeah? Your mind just goes bang, the thought is not completed, because you have dealt with the root cause for the existence of that defilement. Because you dealt with the root cause, the thought itself, the defilement itself is completely gone. Such a wonderful thing, yeah? Such a great thing. And just to support that, there's one nice sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 2, which I haven't included here, I think. I can't remember what I included anymore. I don't think so. Probably not. No. So it's not there. So this sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, I did mention the sutta briefly before, but now is really the right time to mention it. And what this sutta says is that there's two powers. There are two powers on our path of practice. And one of the powers is the Patisankhana Bala. Bala is power. Patisankhana means to reflect, the power of reflection. The other one is the Bhavana Bala. Bhavana is cultivation, yeah? Especially cultivation of the mind. Bhavana Bala, Patisankhana Bala. What is the Patisankhana Bala? The power of reflection is used to overcome defilements, it says. Yeah, through the Patisankhana Bala, by reflecting rightly, we are moving from unwholesome states of mind to wholesome states of mind. Yeah, isn't the Patisankhana Bala? Bhavana Bala, the power of development, what is that? It is the development of the seven factors of awakening. The development of the four jhanas. The development of samadhi. That is what the Bhavana Bala is about. So that comes much later on the path. That's when you start developing your mind properly. Yeah, when you really get into your meditation, etc. That's when that happens. But in the meantime, all the overcoming of the defilements, all your ability in being kind and doing the right thing comes from right reflection. Yeah. Occasionally, it may be okay to use a little bit of willpower. But generally speaking, reflection is the power you want to use. So this shows us also the importance of reflecting rightly on this path, learning to think about things in the right way. And as you do that, these things are disappearing, they are proliferated, annihilated. And you never, they've gone for a long time, of course, not forever, they come back again. And then you do more obliteration until the final obliteration happens toward the end of the path. So that is the first one there, yeah, the abandoning of bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. And of course, then when this has been done, there remain in him middling defilements, sensual thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harm in him. The earnest, capable figure abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. I should say here that when the sutta says figures, yeah, perhaps you think that you are not included in that. Yeah, maybe I'm the only one, yes, I'm not in the way. But no, please don't think like that. The reason why Buddha always talks to the figures in this way is because the main part of the audience he was talking to, would have been the figures. So that's why he says figures. It doesn't mean that this is only for figures, it actually is for everyone. Yeah? Certainly it's for bhikkhunis. Bhikkhunis are exactly like figures. female, and then you have the lay people, and the lay people also practice the same path. The path is the same for everyone. And the reason you're not mentioned is simply because the Buddha always talks to the person, people who are closest to him. An example of that is you find it in the Malakapana Sutta. My brother and all the Buddha's cousins and all the Buddha's family, they have just recently come forward, yeah? So you have Anatta is there, you have Anuruddha is there, Revata is there, Vandiya is there, and of course Devadatta is also there, yeah? Because he also had come forward at that time. And they all come forward, and when the Buddha speaks to them, he talks to them about how their, you know, things are going and what they should practice, this kind of thing. So he always says Anuruddha. Yeah, Anuruddha works, you know, talks as if Anuruddha is the only person there. Why? Because all the others are assumed that, yeah, they come up like that. This is just the way the Buddha, how things were done at that time. So, please don't feel excluded. You are included. So, isn't that nice? So you're part of this. And then we are now moving to the more refined aspects of the defilements. Having just seen the course of one, now moving to the more refined things. Yeah? People still, to overcome ill will completely is quite hard. To overcome sensual thinking completely even more hard. Harming, the last one there, this is the vihinsa probably. Yeah? What does it actually mean? Well, what it means is that you don't care about the result of your actions, what effect it has on other beings. That's really what it means. Avihisa means like, it doesn't mean you're angry with them, just that you couldn't care less what happens, yeah? It's like you walk back home and you kind of see all these insects on the ground and you say, yeah, whatever, I care about them, and then you just kind of walk through them. That's trying to find separate or something like that, yeah? It's not that you're angry with insects, you just couldn't care less about them. Or you're a business person, you work really hard, and you a lot of people kind of, you don't care what happens to the people around you. Yeah, you're just kind of really tough-minded business person, and whether other people kind of, you know, have kind of are hurt by that, by your business, then that doesn't really matter. You don't really care about that. So harming, the opposite of harming here is compassion. When you have compassion, you care for other people's suffering. Yeah, you care whether other people are happy or not, whether they're suffering or not. So harming, compassion, and vihinsa are here the opposite. So opposite of, in this case, is a compassionate. A compassionate person cares. They don't have a cold heart. They are considerate. They are not ruthless. Yeah, ruthless is a nice word. Yeah, ruthless means you don't care about the rest of the world. Yeah, doesn't mean you're angry. You don't care less what happens to them. That is what is meant by this word. Sometimes it's called cruelty, but that's also kind of misses the point a little bit. So ruthlessness is quite a nice translation for that word. So don't be ruthless, be ruthful. Yeah, you think I'm joking. I'm not joking, actually. This is actually true. Ruth in English, the word ruth is a name. Yeah? People call ruth, but the actual meaning of that name is compassion. So if you're ruthful, you're compassionate. This was actually a word in English back in the 17th century or something. Yeah? I didn't know this until I looked it up. I thought, wow, that's really cool, but ruthful, okay. And I started using that word now on that. But nobody has used it for 200 years, so you haven't heard it before. It's very surprising. So you, again, remember here how to overcome these thoughts, yeah? Again, it's exactly the same thing that I was talking about before, about even though it says here, obliterate, all this kind of stuff, it doesn't actually mean that you use willpower to overcome these things, you use wisdom power. And this can be very useful in the meditation practice. Yeah? Sometimes we get disturbed by these crazy thoughts in meditation. Suddenly we feel upset about something. It's very disturbing meditation. Yeah? You sit there and then suddenly this person comes into your mind and you start getting a bit upset. That is where this kind of power can be used right there in your meditation. It also can be used in ordinary life, but especially in your meditation practice. So when this happens in your meditation, you see kind of getting upset about something, because you have been taught well what to do, you know what you have to do in that particular point. You know that, okay, what are the good qualities of this person? And if the person has no good qualities, then you know people like that with no good qualities? Sometimes there are people, it's so hard to see the good qualities of someone, yeah? It doesn't mean they haven't got that, but we can't see them. Then you have compassion for them. Because a person who has no good qualities, they are in serious trouble, yeah? You may have to bear the brunt of their stupidity a little bit, but actually they are the ones who really have a big problem at home. Then you have compassion for them. Yeah? So there's no person in the world that we cannot have a positive perception towards. So this is the beauty of it. So this is what I mean by obliterating these thoughts. You shift your perspective, you look at the person in a new way, and that new way abandon these things so rapidly. Yeah? Displays, when you think about it, it's so obvious. Yeah, it is so incredibly obvious. It's weird. And we actually need the Buddha to point these things out to us. And anybody should be able to understand this, and yet we don't. We actually need the Buddha to say, you know, think about this. It's pretty rational. You know, if you do this, then you're going to be happy. If you do this, you're going to be angry. Actually, it's very simple, man. But sometimes the most basic things in life, because we don't really consider them properly, man, we often don't get them right. So, this is how you overcome the thing. We'll have more look at this in much more detail later on. This is just an introduction. Okay, then there remain in him subtle defilements, thoughts about his relations or her relations, thoughts about their country, thoughts about their reputation. The earnest, capable person abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. Yeah, these are refined defilements about your relations, country, and about your reputation. What is this all about? These are subtle defilements of the mind that have to do a little bit with desires. A lot of this has to do with our sense of self. Yeah. Who are we? Well, this is exactly the things we are. We are from such a country, this is our family, our reputation is like our education, our social status, all these kind of things. So this has a lot to do with our sense of self, who we are. And the sense of self is something that is very annoying in meditation practice. Very often the sense of self wants to exert itself. Yeah, we feel like you are somebody, and often that feeling of being someone, it has to be upheld. How is it upheld? It's upheld by feeling yourself, yeah? You justify yourself, you keep saying who you are. I'm not like that, I'm like this. Somebody says, oh, you messed up. Actually, no, I didn't really mess up, I tried my best, but you know, conditions and circumstances were wrong, so it's not really my fault. And so we kind of try to justify ourselves. The sense of self is very, it can be a very big hindrance in meditation because it is the creator of so much thought that justifies its own existence. And this is kind of the idea here, that you reduce all of that. You don't think so much about your own country anymore, about your reputation, about who you are. The sense of self starts to subside. Yeah, if you realize actually it's quite irrelevant. And the way to do this is just by gradually, as you meditate. And if mind becomes more peaceful, this thing tend to fall away. Until there comes a point when you are completely empty inside, when your mind is completely silent, there's nothing going on, who are you? You're nobody. When your mind is really empty, what can you say about yourself? Not very much, yeah? Okay, I am awareness, yeah? I am, you still maybe what happened, I am happiness. But you can't really say much, but the sense of self is largely gone. And it's such a beautiful thing when the sense of self starts to disappear. It's a wonderful release, yeah? It's a kind of liberation from something actually quite oppressive. You don't have to justify yourself so much anymore. You don't have to prove yourself to anyone, because you are kind of empty. And also, one of the kind of great benefits about the sense of self disappearing is that you know, one of the things it does, it eliminates some of the other barriers in the world. Sense of self creates barriers. I have this nationality. I am proud of being Australian, yeah? I'm not Australian, so I'm kind of an immigrant to Australia, so I can say this. But this is what you see in Australia. You see kind of something is produced over there, and then it depends on the kind of the, whatever it is, the honey bottle that is proudly made in Australia, yeah? And I think, okay. But I think it's stupid. Why are you proudly made? I said, okay, you made the honey. Great, wonderful, good on you, and I'm enjoying it. But, you know, why make this into an Australian thing? You know? And this is how we create this sense of identity around things. I'm from this country. I have this kind of background. I'm educated so and so. I have this is who I am. Yeah? And when we take all of those things away, we take away the barriers in the world. We can have equally much metta and kindness for anyone. We can relate how to relate to other people. We start to see that actually we're pretty much all the same. Yeah? Which is actually very nice. Because when we're all the same, we can talk to each other, we can understand each other on a deeper level. This is the beauty of the Buddha's teaching. This is why we are so universal. Because it's deep to everybody then. Yeah, the barrier of taking away that. And then we can have more sympathy for people of different religions, for example. We have come together as Buddhists. But that too is taken away. When you are empty inside, you don't feel like a Buddhist anymore. Yeah, you don't claim I'm a Buddhist when you're kind of in deep meditation or whatever. That's also gone. And then it opens up our hearts. And this is the kind of thing which allows metta to be possible. Real metta can have everything through everyone in the whole world. Even the terrorists, even the stupid people, and the compassionists, because the barriers have been withdrawn. That's actually a wonderful thing when these things happen. The subtle little defilements can be quite annoying and quite problematic. And these disappear as you go deeper into your meditation practice. How do we do this in meditation? Well, we do it just by being peaceful. Allowing the mind to die down by observing, being quiet, and all these kind of things. I will say a little bit more about meditation practice when we come together in the next session, because just to give you some basic guidance, I should maybe have asked you first of all, is there anyone here who is new to meditation practice? Who hasn't done much meditation? Okay, yeah, 1, 2, 3, okay, 4, yeah, okay, great. So I will give you some a bit more guidance there, because it's good to be reminded anyway of the basics of meditation, regardless. Okay, so all of these departments go, yeah, you obliterate them by thinking skillfully, yeah. Why do I bother being kind of what do I really need to think about my education and my country and my family? Does this really matter? And after a while you realize that this is being silly. I don't really need to think about these things at all. But much better to be a universal human being rather than to be a specific, limited person. As you think about this in the right way, you abandon this as well. Then what happens next? Now it's starting to get really exciting, yeah? The less defilements you have, the more interesting things get, and the more exciting the meditation becomes. So now things really start to happen. When this has been done, then there remain thoughts connected with the Dhamma. That stillness is not yet peaceful and sublime, not attained to full tranquility, not attained to unification, but is reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilements. Okay, so I don't agree with this translation, and I wrote to Vicky Bodhi about it, and in this case he wouldn't listen to me. Very often he listens to me, and Vicky Bodhi is very nice. You might even say, can we please change this, because I was working with him on this translation. And very often he's very open-minded, but in this case he wouldn't listen. And that's terrible, isn't it? the way I would translate this is that when this has been done, there remain not thoughts connected with the Dhamma, but thoughts that are in accordance with the Dhamma. Because any thought can be connected with the Dhamma in the sense that it may not be wholesome or whatever, but thoughts that accord with the Dhamma, in other words, thoughts that are kind, thoughts that are compassionate, thoughts that are renunciant, yeah? You're still thinking, but you're thinking on a very subtle level. This is what you see when you look at the Sutta, the Tvedavitaka Sutta I was talking about before. The Buddha says exactly that. You overcome, first of all, you overcome the bad thoughts by thinking good thoughts. Then you overcome the good thoughts by abandoning thinking altogether. Again, it's the right sequence that comes in. The thoughts that accord with the Dhamma, yeah, you're doing pretty well at that point, but even they have to go. And actually, it's quite easy. Once you're thinking, it's becoming very positive. It's much, much easier to abandon those things. And then it says, that stillness, that samadhi, is not peaceful and sublime. This is a very standard description of real samadhi in the sutras. Santa, santa is the word for peaceful, and sublime is panita. This is kind of to think, when the Buddha says something is sublime, you really mean this is kind of the highest sublime that's available then. Not gazing to full tranquility, you're not yet fully tranquilized, yeah? Because you're thinking, like, there's still a bit of movement in the mind. But thinking is like a movement of the mind. It's not yet complete, it's still focused on one thing. So, not yet fully tranquilized, not attained to unification, one of the kind of main ideas of samadhi in that the mind is unified. Yeah, what does it mean to unify? Unify means that it is all coming together around one particular thing, yeah? One feeling, iti sukha, happiness and joy, and no movement, nothing beyond that. This is when you know the mind is getting to samadhi. Iti still, no movement, just bliss, nothing else happening. One of the characteristics of samadhi. But it is reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing. Forcefully, sankhara here. Sankhara really refers to the will I was referring to before. So it is reined in and checked by the will. That's really what it means. And suppressing too, I don't really like the word suppressing, because I don't think that's what's going on. It's more like to gradually abandon these defilements. So you are still using your will a little bit. You're still using your will to think in the right way, using wisdom, reflecting rightly. And as you do that, then these things are abandoned. The will is still present. And this is a very interesting thing, because this is one of the kind of things that we often talk about in meditation, is there still will left when you come to the jhanas or not? When you come to really deep samadhi, is there any sense of, you know, doing there? Is the agent still present at a particular point? And this is one of the few places where it actually shows us. I mean, when you come to deep samadhi, yeah, here the agent is still present. The next paragraph is the opposite. That sankhara, that force, that will is gone. Yeah, so it shows, I think, this particular passage that when you come into really deep meditation, the agent inside, the will, is completely gone. Yeah, no more will then. Completely gone. How is that possible? Well, the reason it's possible is because it's like you feel you are frozen. You're in a frozen state, and you can't get out. Sounds scary, yeah? You've been put in prison, you can't get out anymore. But of course, you're very happy to be there. You're so happy. You're so pleased. Freeze me more often, yeah? It's so great. That's what you think. Please lock that door. Don't let me out again, because it's so wonderful to be here. So it is the jhanas, when you really get there, there are frozen states whereby you're so happy to be there. And all your experience is one thing all the time, nothing else. And this is one of the few passages in the sutra that can make that feeling clear, that sankharas are abandoned at a particular point. So then, look what I said at the very end here. But vigorously, there comes a time when his or her mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and stilled. That stillness is peaceful and sublime, gained to full tranquility, attained to unification. It is not reined in and checked by the will. The defilements are not reined and checked by the will. And then there is a suitable basis. Then, being a suitable basis, he is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which it might incline his mind. So again, there comes a time, yes, you just meditate. You are just kind of sitting there, you're relaxing, you're watching your breath, yeah, things are becoming very nice and peaceful. You haven't yet gone all the way into samadhi, yeah? You just chill. You don't desire somebody to do anything. There's no, you don't know when it's going to happen. But eventually, if you keep on doing this, if you keep on putting in the courses of meditation, the results will eventually have to happen. There comes a time. We can't say when, but we can say at the time. Will definitely come. If you keep on applying yourself, this is what's going to happen. And what is it that happens? What happens is that you become internally steady, composed, unified, and still. But this is a shortcut for the jhanas in the sutra, because it is used very often. So you attain the jhana state. And that is why that samadhi is called peaceful and sublime. Now you're entering sublime territory here, really peaceful territory, gain to full tranquility. There's nothing anymore. It's steady as a rock. Attained to unity. There's only one perception. Only one thing happening. Yeah? Moment after moment. Hour after hour. Nothing is moving. All you have is this bliss all the time. Yeah? Sounds good. Yeah? Would you like to go in? Anyone would like to go in? If you say no, then... I'm not sure what to say. You say no. This is kind of the Buddha telling the Dhamma, and we'll see much more about this later on. This whole idea that the Buddha's path is about happiness, joy, really, really positive things. And then that samadhi is not checked and by the will. The hindrances of defilement are not checked by the will anymore. The will is gone. There is no agent inside anymore. You are kind of in a frozen state after you come out again. Then, there being a suitable basis, the suitable basis is all of this what he has done now, the practice of the jhana, the practice of samadhi, that is that basis. Now there is a suitable basis. You are capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge, abhinya, the Pali word, towards which you might incline your mind. Anything you want to do, you can do at this particular point. Maybe you have to go a little bit deeper, maybe you have to go to the fourth jhana, yeah? Sometimes you need to go a bit deeper. But somewhere along these jhanas, wherever you incline your mind, you will be able to do it. So what are you going to do? Are you going to kind of... Anything you can do, yeah, you can walk through the walls and fly through the air, you can walk on the water, and you can tell the Christians, ah, oh, Jesus, he did nothing. Look at this, and he walked on water. That's my problem, they don't do that, I was being naughty. So you can do all those things, yeah, that would be kind of the waste of a nice state of meditation if you use it. You can do that, you can also play around with it, you can listen to the thoughts of others, you can do all this kind of thing, like what's it called? But of course, what you really want to do at this particular point, when your mind is ready, that is when your mind is ready for the real vichara, for the three insights, the same vichara, and the insights into past lives, to understand your karma, and eventually becoming an arahant. That's exactly what this is all about. So that is what you want to direct your mind towards. If you also want a bonus, the other bonus is kind of flying through the air like a bird. But it is not really required, it is not really all that useful at all, except for the bad factors, because really all this is so that's it, yeah? The whole path, all the way to full awakening can be done through this gradual practice. And this particular sutta shows us the gradual training in brief. This can be expanded out to be very long. If you go to some of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya and the Majjhima Nikaya, in the Digha Nikaya you have like the Samanyapala Sutta, which I know that you know it way in.
No, I don't know it.
So,
I know, but I haven't read it.
Okay, we should read it one of these days. It's a beautiful sutta, which has the whole gradual training spanning out, a very long process. It shows all the details of the gradual training. And that gradual training occurs so many times in the suttas, 20, 30 times you find it in the suttas. And because of that, you know that this is one of the critical suttas to understand what we have to do. It is really just an expansion of the noble eightfold path. Now you have seen that in brief. This is what that gradual training is all about. And over the next few days, we're going to expand on this and look at these things in more detail. How to deal with the mind, how to overcome these things. And as part of that, we're also going to have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on mindfulness of breathing. Very beautiful and powerful little sutta. But before we do that, we're going to have a little break. And we will see you back, because we're patient together in about 15 minutes.